Welcome to Security Squad, a CertSecurity.com podcast for October 13th, 2011. This month on Security Squad, we'll talk about the value of CISSP certification. Then Mozilla pays out more than $100,000 to bug hunters. The PCI Security Standards Council issues a report on point-to-point encryption. All that and more on Security Squad. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rob Westerveld. In the studio this month, we have Mike Mimoso. Mike is editorial director of the Security Media Group. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Rob.
And, of course, Eric Parizeau joins us. Eric is senior site editor of CertSecurity.com and does a lot of work with the rest of the websites in the Security Media Group. Hey, Eric.
Hi, Rob.
Before we start down the path of our agenda here, I wanted to start out with some very new data that was released by Microsoft this week. Volume 11 of Microsoft's Security Intelligence Report focuses on zero-day exploits, and the statistics are very interesting, I thought. For the first half of 2011, zero-day exploits accounted for only 0.12% of all exploit activity, according to Microsoft. Zero-day exploits reached a peak of 0.37% in June, so they did rise a little bit. But the bulk of these zero-day exploits tracked by Microsoft were targeting two vulnerabilities, and those were vulnerabilities disclosed in Adobe Flash Player in June. I wonder, I guess, if some of the news reporting that we've been doing over the last several years and some of the messages that we've been getting from security vendors and security researchers at these security vendors has been a bit overblown with zero-day exploits, the whole theme of zero days and how serious they are.
Well, Rob, I think you're absolutely wrong.
Let me
tell you why. I don't think it matters how much malware is out there. It matters what malware is going to be successful exploiting enterprise systems.
Mm-hmm.
The implications of a single zero-day attack can be much more widespread and devastating than your typical run-of-the-mill piece of malware that, you know, exploits, for instance, a Microsoft flaw that an organization just hasn't patched. Some organizations will have patched it, and hence that exploit will be less widely successful. The best evidence, I think, of why zero days are so dangerous, goes back to, late 2009 with the Operation Aurora attack, where you had an IE zero day that was exploited almost simultaneously on dozens of different organizations, leading to, near universally successful exploits. Now, in a lot of cases, these organizations applied, defense in depth, layered security, and were able to detect the attacks with reasonable levels of success, which, good for them. It goes to show exactly how important that layered security is. But at the same time, it's a perfect example of how the right zero-day attack can be used to launch a devastating coordinated attack. So I think even if the zero days are few and far between, mm-hmm. because the potential for damage is so high, you have to focus on that as a top priority.
Mike, what's your take on this? You've done a lot of reporting on zero days over the years.
Let's ask RSA what they think of zero days.
Was that a zero day? Was the exploit used in the attachment?
It was a flash zero day.
It was?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, it was embedded in another file.
In an Excel
file, exactly. But essentially it was, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think the point is that, nobody's using a zero day for a mass attack anymore. These things are all very targeted, and, if APT or whatever you want to call it, these are very specialized pieces of malware, and they're very damaging. The rest of the world gets caught up in the SQL injections and cross-site scripting and those, run-of-the-mill everyday flaws that have been around for 20 years, buffer overflow stuff. That's what hits the majority of folks out there. The zero days are used in much more serious attacks, and I think that's the point here that's being made. Right, when you get vendors coming in here or researchers talking about zero days, it's a little overblown, and there's some FUD on the vendor's part trying to push their products.
Yeah, typically they have services or some sort of feature in their product for
zero-day
tracking.
Depends on who you are and what you do. But
I will say I think it's worth mentioning the recent CSIS report that was from earlier this month, which mentioned that five specific applications are supposedly responsible for 99% of all successful malware infections. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Java, Reader and Acrobat, Flash, IE, and QuickTime.
Makes
now,
sense.
Now, when you're talking about zero-day attacks, it's incredibly likely that the zero-day is going to exploit one of those five applications, just because that's where they're the easiest targets for a variety of reasons. So if you're talking about a zero-day against random SAP application or whatever, then it's probably going to be less likely and hence less of a concern. But certainly against these kinds of applications, the zero-day threat needs to be a high priority for enterprises to worry about.
Speaking of vulnerabilities, this kind of plays right into it. Let's talk about the bug bounty program that Mozilla has. And basically, Mozilla presented data at the OWASP AppSec USA conference in September on its web vulnerability bug bounty program. These are bugs that are reported on its various websites. Our friends at ThreatPost reported on this particular presentation. Mozilla's bug bounty program was launched in December. It offers rewards of up to $3,000 for certain kinds of vulnerabilities reported on its websites. Since December 2010, the company paid out $104,000 to vulnerability researchers. So it seems to be a fairly worthwhile program for Mozilla because nearly 75% of that money has gone out to high-priority bugs that qualified for this $3,000 reward. In November, it had only three reports. In November 2010, there was only three bug reports sent to Mozilla on its websites. When it launched the program, that number jumped to 87 bug reports.
I think it shows that at least in Mozilla's case, the bug bounty program is a success. As you said, mm-hmm. when it kicked off, it started with 87, which was a pretty big number. But according to the numbers I saw in their data, it steadily declined in that time since then. So it shows to me that either there's less interest in the program, which is a possibility, but unlikely given the amount of money that they've given out over time, or the more likely answer is that the program is working and members of the community are submitting these bugs. They're getting fixed, and the result is fewer software flaws, in the Mozilla code base, which is exactly what the program is designed to do. So, yeah. I think it's a good thing. I think more organizations should do it to some extent. And credit to Microsoft, to your point, for at least getting on board, not necessarily with a bug bounty, more with a kind of a resolution bounty, if you will, and which makes sense. We've talked about that in the past. But, for our listeners, if you're an enterprise considering a software purchase and you're concerned about security, I think if your potential vendor has a bug bounty program, that should be a notch in its favor because it shows the organization is concerned about security, wants flaws to be found and fixed, and is encouraging its users and software developers out there to help with that process.
Of 175 bugs submitted to date, 64% of them actually qualified for the reward program. I think that's a relatively high number that would get a reward.
Yeah, it certainly goes to show that, like any software, it has serious flaws in it if you're willing to dig deep enough. But if those flaws are going to be found, you want them to be found by the good guys, by people who are going to report those flaws to you and not use it to exploit your software. And that's exactly what this program is trying to do.
Mike, your take on this?
Yeah, it's an open platform, so everybody has a chance to look at it. I mean, we've met with folks from Mozilla and Mozilla Security, and that while everybody has a chance to look at the code and submit fixes or submit bugs, there's a very small core of people that actually touch the tree and do code implementation. So I'm wondering, how many of those people are involved in this bounty and how many of these findings are coming from outside the program itself. But it's definitely a win. I mean, they've paid out $104,000. It's a drop in the bucket to get these high-profile bugs fixed. So it's definitely a win for them.
Well, very good. I want to move on to another report that just came out this week. So Symantec issued a report called Motivations of Recent Android Malware, and it outlined several ways attackers have made money by targeting Android smartphones. But the gist of the report basically is that the desktop is still far greater an attractive target these days for attackers than the mobile space, and that we're still a number of years out before we're going to see a really precipitous increase in attacks targeting mobile devices. Eric, you had some thoughts on this report, and I thought that it was the interesting piece here, at least to me, was that Symantec was saying, wait a sec, we're still a number of years away from the mobile apocalypse. It's not as big a threat as, you know, we seem to be trumpeting right now.
And I think Symantec is way off in this one. I mean,
okay,
the devil is at the doorstep already here. Let me dig into this a little bit. Now, the key part or key line in the opening part of the report for me was, and this is from Eric Chin, the technical director at Security Response, only if these monetization schemes succeed do we expect attackers to continue to invest in the creation of Android malware. They seem to be focused on a variety of unusual, you know, money specific attacks like premium rate billing and pay per click, and maybe those things are relevant to some extent, but let's focus on what's happening today and what we've seen in terms of a market ramp up in Android malware and Android attacks this year. In recent weeks, we've seen attacks on, unpatched Android vulnerabilities that allow, unauthorized applications to install and steal user data, Google Android devices being involved in botnets, according to Damballa, the Gingerbread Gingermaster attack, uploading device information. Multiple reports have said that Android malware attacks are escalating to a critical mass already. This is already happening. And I don't understand why Symantec, A, isn't acknowledging that more prominently, and B, isn't focusing on the attacks that are happening today to steal consumer and enterprise data using these devices. To me, Symantec's report is not only misleading, it's borderline irresponsible.
I've been reporting that mobile malware still represented a relatively small portion of the overall malware picture, and it's still 1% or less.
Okay, great, wonderful. If 98% of malware is getting stopped at the firewall or the desktop, then the 1% that's attacking, largely undefended Android devices is what really matters. So then you shouldn't ignore the 1%, even though it is 1%.
Yeah, but we're talking about devices that have been built from the ground up with security in mind. For example, the sandboxing feature. I bring it up every single time we talk about about mobile devices, but their platforms are very different from desktop platforms, and that there are security features built in to isolate attacks,
which on the Android platform has already been exploited. Go on.
The other factor that I mentioned to Symantec, and they agreed, is that right now, mobile devices don't really have a lot of valuable data on them. They have some stored email, cached email.
Stored email. I'm going to stop you right there. Because again, that is absolutely, totally, ridiculously
Why
wrong.
Is that ridiculously the wrong? The majority of applications on mobile devices are web-based. They tap into some sort of cloud infrastructure to pull in data. They don't store the data on the device. If they did, there wouldn't be enough storage on these devices right now.
Rob, I recommend you go back and spend some time watching our virtual seminar on information security threats that we had a couple weeks ago.
Excellent.
On searchsecurity.com, because we did we did an entire session on what we called the hunt for credentials. That's what attackers are really after now. They want valid username password combinations so that they don't need a zero day or malware to get into an enterprise network. They have valid credentials. They can just log in, and that's what these Android devices have on them. Enterprise users too often use their credentials.
Then why
on
haven't
these devices
we seen
to access
a
the network
breach yet that involved a mobile device? If this is such a serious threat, why haven't we seen a breach that somehow connected to either a tablet or a mobile device, whether it be stolen credentials or what have you.
Because with stolen credentials, you're talking about a valid login. A valid login is hard to pinpoint as a breach. If someone has your username and password, it just looks like you logged into the system. So it's hard to even pinpoint that as
the
actual
other,
breach.
The other
event.
Issue here is that these any passwords that are stored on the phone on any of these devices are A, encrypted, and B, part of the underlying infrastructure of the device itself. It's not something that can be easily targeted by an attacker. They have to exploit some sort of vulnerability either in an application on the phone, and then B, root the phone itself in order to get some of this valuable data.
Once you have the credential data, the battle's over, because you can basically do whatever you need to do offline to, you know, make use of that credential data. It's kind of like, you know, stealing the keys to the kingdom and saying that, well, we have a lot of guards. You know, no one can get past those guards. Well, if they do, it's game over. So I think it's a major, major problem. And enterprises, the whole point I'm trying to make is that, you know, I think contrary to what Symantec is saying in terms of, you know, potentially downplaying the risk Android devices represent, don't be fooled. Android devices represent a considerable risk to the enterprise today.
I'm going to pile on Eric. I think it's a ho-hum report, totally. I don't think we're at that tipping point yet with mobile devices where I think you made a good point with it was near-field communications.
Right.
I think when devices become payment tokens, that's when serious attention is going to be paid to mobile malware and attacks on mobile devices. Mm-hmm. I think people are playing in Android because it's an open platform and you can create code and you can do proof of concept. And I think that's what these things are right now.
The whole point of Symantec's report here is that attackers are businessmen and women. They want to make money, and they want to make a lot of money with the least amount of investment. And right now, they're still on the desktop because that's where the money is. That's where they can reach the masses.
My argument is no, that's changing. It's changing now. For the reasons I talked about,
it's changing gradually.
I think the platforms are different, clearly. I agree with you there, but the attacker motivations are the same. As you say, they're looking for financially driven attacks that can make them a lot of money. And I still
say... always got to get the last word in.
You have the editing software.
I do.
You want me to just stop now? I'll just stop.
No. I think it's a really good debate, and it's something worth watching, especially with some of the technologies that were outlined in the Symantec report, including near-field communications, because it's going to be interesting when the device in our pocket turns into a payment device.
Last point.
Turns into a wallet.
Again, for our audience, I'm worried about what my problem is today and maybe what my problem is tomorrow. And the problem today is that, you know, Android malware is increasing, these devices are being exploited, and I'm sure the average enterprise information security pro knows that most users have a whole lot of information about their company on their devices that they do not want attackers to get.
Booyah.
Well, speaking of valuable data, the PCI Council issued a new report that really is the foundation of a new certification program that will certify point-to-point encryption technologies. Point-to-point encryption, for people that may not know, is the use of encryption when a credit card is swiped at the point-of-sale terminal and is encrypted all the way to the payment processor where it's decrypted. Up until now, enterprises that have been early adopters who really had no way to verify any of the claims made by point-to-point encryption providers. So now in April, the PCI Council will come out with a list of certified point-to-point encryption products. They're going to focus on hardware-based encryption. So, for example, hardware security modules, which are involved in the encryption process, will be listed there, along with some other devices.
I think the devil's in the details. You need to know what the testing procedures are going to be to validate these applications, these programs. You know, there's always that specter of pay-per-play. I mean, who gets on the list and why and how, and, you know, who gets to the top of the list, who gets to the bottom of the list. There's always that kind of cloud over these kinds of things. And, you know, it happened with the payment application program that they have, and it's It might happen with this one, too.
I was speaking to a representative of Thales. They make hardware security modules. And this person was on the working group that put together the validation requirements that will become the certification list.
There you go.
So, and of course, the PCI Council will say that, well, their working group that creates these validation requirements is made up of a number of vendors and other representatives. So, I mean, this is something that I think is pretty important. They're going to move from hardware-based point-to-point encryption to software-based and hybrid approaches. And we'll see how merchants and QSAs respond when they assess a merchant's systems and whether point-to-point encryption really does reduce the scope that many of these point-to-point encryption vendors or providers say it does.
I will say, to what you're getting at, Rob, it seems like the issue enterprises have with the assessment process a lot of times is that certain QSAs are more specific than others. And, you know, if the guidelines do suggest a certain kind of technology, then I do wonder if some QSAs are going to key in on, you know, a couple vendors versus, you know, a broader scope. And that in turn is going to certainly cause some problems for a number of companies, as well as, again, you know, pose some ethical questions too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I spoke to one QSA who's very positive on this, and he said that, you know, he has actually seen some merchants who have been duped by software providers into buying a payment application that supposedly was PCI certified or certified by the PCI Council, when in fact had the certification that the software provider had was just, it had its system certified by the PCI Council. It had nothing to do with their application. Mm-hmm. And the application was loaded with holes and what have you, vulnerabilities. And so he thinks that, you know, having a certification list will help vendors say, okay, you're on this list. You know, it's not a catch-all. It's not a silver bullet. It doesn't mean that you're going to gain PCI compliance. You still have to do all of the other things necessary.
We just saw the Verizon report that came out a couple weeks ago that said that most organizations, you know, as we've suspected for quite a while,
fail to maintain.
Can't maintain after right. their assessment anyway.
Absolutely. And speaking of QSAs, actually, most of them are CISSP certified. And Eric, I know you attended the ISC Square conference where ISC, the organization that maintains the CISSP certification, told you that they're going to be really pushing it to really get a broader number of CISSP certified security professionals. And with that, I think comes some fear that the CISSP will be devalued. You had actually a good interview with Horde Tipton, the executive director of ISC Squared, Eric.
Yeah, I had a long interview with Horde Tipton at the inaugural ISC Squared Security Congress in Orlando a couple weeks ago. For anyone who hasn't seen that, that's on the video section of the searchsecurity.com homepage. You can check that out. But the takeaway for me, and I tried to articulate this in the column I wrote last month, was it's not an easy issue. It definitely has two sides to it, where on one hand, you have ISC Squared that believes that there's a great a lack of qualified InfoSec pros out there today for enterprises to hire, which in turn leads to more insecurity because companies don't have the resources, the human resources they need to implement security successfully. So they're naturally trying to grow their organization to try to help the industry in that way. But of course, at the same time, they're also trying to, you know, increase their membership, which increases their revenue. On the other side of the coin, you have the, 70 plus thousand existing CISSPs who believe that the organization isn't doing enough for them, who are already the ones, you know, footing the bill for ISC Squared. So it's a tough problem. There are challenges on both sides. On one hand, you can certainly understand why ISC Squared needs to grow. But on the other hand, it's also important for them to recognize that it's the existing members that give the certification its value in the first place. But
Eric,
I don't know.
our existing CISSPs maintaining their certification?
Well,
is there any indication? Did ISC Squared release any data?
Yeah, I talked to Hort about that, and it's one of the reasons why he believes that the certification remains so strong today. I don't remember the exact figure. I know it's in my column, but a significant portion of the CISSP certification base falls off every year, simply because they they don't maintain the certification for one reason or another. So there's actually there was a surprising amount of turnover. So even though you have new people coming in all the time, you have people falling off.
Whether they retire or move on to other positions where it's not needed.
Exactly, variety of things. So I was surprised with just how stringent they are with maintaining the rigor of the standard itself. They told me that they actually break down the entire certification test every 18 months, if not more frequently, and reassess every question, so that if you're not up to date on the latest security technologies and issues that are taking place in the industry right now, you're not going to pass the test. So it certainly opened my eyes to what they're doing that I don't think a lot of people realize in order to keep the certification strong.
Just so that I understand, once you pass that test, you don't have to retake a test, right? You just have to maintain your credits by attending different meetings, stuff like that.
You have to maintain your credits, but ISC Squared, of course, is in charge of deciding what you're allowed to get credits for. Mm-hmm. So they can certainly drive the ongoing education agenda of existing members.
Interesting. Mike, I've talked to a number of security pros just in my daily reporting, and I can't think of I feel like I consistently run into security professionals who kind of grumble about CISSP.
Yeah, totally.
Especially when I go to a conference like RSA.
A lot of snarky comments.
So you get the same thing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, not too long ago, when you look at the total number of CISSPs, it was in the 30s, 34,000, 33,000. And that number's jumped to 76,000, 78,000, whatever it is now. Obviously, more than double in a relatively short amount of time. So obviously, the indication there is ISC Squared, spends a lot of time recruiting and trying to raise revenue. And that's fine. They're a business. What are they giving back to the existing CISSPs? That's the grumble. I hear a lot of complaints about their ethics policy. People that just do something wrong and aren't kicked out, don't have their certification revoked, aren't fined or penalized in any kind of way. I don't know if they can fine. But there isn't a lot of. The perception is that there isn't a lot of give back from ISC Squared. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. I'm not a CISSP. I'm not on the mailing lists and so forth. But that's definitely one of the big grumbles that we hear.
Interesting. And I'm sure, if you're somebody like somebody with a high profile, you're not going to have to attend a number of user group meetings to obtain your credits in order to maintain your CISSP. If you are, say...
if you are a high-profile whoever, you don't need a CISSP to get a job. That's the door for a lot of jobs, and that's why people pursue the certification and invest the time in it. And, it's a book test. There's not a lot of practical application during that test. There is some, but it's not a very specific certification like some of the SANS or vendor-specific certs.
For all the people that do grumble about CISSP, I know there are a lot of people that also are very proud of their CISSP certification.
Well, it is an accomplishment. I mean, it's involved.
They're proud enough that it's listed usually in their their resume.
And there's a financial investment website in it. It's several hundred dollars, if not more, to take the test. I'm not even sure. But regardless, you have to invest the time to study and pass the test, and chances are you don't get it at the first crack. There's nothing wrong with it per se. But again, it's like compliance. It's a snapshot in time. It's what do you know today? And, you have to maintain that baseline of knowledge.
Yeah. Eric, you attended the conference. What was attendance like? What were CISSPs saying?
Attendance was strong. It was co-located with the ACES physical security conference. So there was a lot of overlap between physical and logical security. Mm-hmm. And a lot of interesting topics there. But I think, in a way, the conference is one of the things the organization is trying to use to give back to the existing members. They want to create opportunities where members can come together and share knowledge. That's been one of the complaints, and they do survey the membership fairly often, is that members want better opportunities to interact and exchange information with other CISSPs. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, industry organizations out there, but to know that you're going to be interacting with other CISSPs who have been vetted in the same process that you have, I mean, it creates a level of quality there, and you can understand why members would want that. So I think the conference is part of that. They're trying to create a new regional program similar to the NESIG group where people in different regions can come together and share knowledge. So, you know, again, credit to them for doing that. But I think part of the problem is also finding these sorts of programs that will appeal broadly to a lot of existing CISSPs, because in a way, I don't think it's necessarily clear what they can do to appeal or appease a lot of the existing CISSPs.
Well, that does it for this edition of Security Squad. Be sure to check out our previous podcasts by going to our podcast landing page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. And as always, you can get the latest security news and information by going to our news page at searchsecurity.com/news. For Eric Perrizzo and Mike Mimoso, I'm Rob Westervelt. Have a great day.